Today is January 29th, 2023. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
Chilly. It's quite cold in Denver today, and I'm having to add wood to my fire.
Okay, yeah, it's windy. Windy and cold here in Flagstaff as the next front approaches. So, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. After you and I finished a part 4 interview, we were talking, and you mentioned that you had climbed Shiprock in 1963, and I about fell out of my chair. And I wondered if you could take some time at the start of this interview to recount that climb. Who did you climb it with, and what do you recall about it?
That was with Vin Holman, my closest climbing friend in the CSU Hikers Club. And that was part, I think, of a drive that we made around close to that time. Ending up, I think, at Fort Stanton, New Mexico, or maybe that was before, and doing an important bit of caving in that cave there. But
okay.
In any case, Shiprock. Let's see, how should I describe that? We had another Hikers Club friend, Ray Collier, who at that time had a house he was intermittently staying in Mancos, Colorado.
Hmm.
And he was gone for a bit, so Vin and I spent a night there.
Is that C-O-L-L-I-E-R?
No, it's C-O-L-Y-E-R.
Thank you.
Yes, and Vin had done some research, and he had found that there was only one ascent in the month of December of Shiprock before that. And at that time, we didn't know of any restrictions by the Indians on visiting these places, so we just drove down there and began climbing Shiprock.
Was that your idea? Was it Vin's idea? Was it both of yours?
I think it was his idea, about which I was enthusiastic.
Okay.
But he's the one who noted how it's ranked in the timing. So I found that Shiprock was rather scary, because it was a volcanic breccia tower, basically, remnant of an abrupt explosive eruption some millions of years ago, and this wasn't very well consolidated. It tended to be crumbly, and I didn't trust the holds very much. Although I was looking at what was in that material, and at one point I saw this gray pebble about 2 inches across, and I realized that that's a chunk of what appears to be Leadville limestone.
Oh, wow.
A Mississippian rock that Shiprock is probably a couple of thousand feet below the surface. And so I could see that this eruption had torn rocks up from the sedimentary layers buried in that locality, and
wow.
I put this chunk of limestone way up there. So the first and middle parts, as I recall, of the ascent, we were on the west side, which I think is the side that's been mostly done, and it losing track of my thought, but in any case, the first part part were the most scary, the highest angle and crumbliest. But about midway or higher, there were, was a lowering of angle, and one could move for a while without so much concern about falling.
Okay.
And then the summit itself, I don't remember a great deal about the character of that, but apparently it wasn't that bad, or I would have had recollections. However, it was getting quite late in the afternoon.
Ooh.
As you know, December has the shortest night, or shortest days.
Yes.
And we had brought our carbide lamps up there, which we had in anticipation of caving, and it got dark on us. I forget what we anchored to, but in some way we were able to first light our carbide lamps. Luckily we had wind protectors on them, and I forget if we anchored to some hardware that had been installed on the summit or not, but there was something that we were able to double rope and then rope down the face to the west at quite steep angle. There was a ledge or two that gave us apparently other anchors, because I don't think we did that in a single rappel.
Right. It's too tall for that, unless you had a terribly long rope.
Yes, we didn't have, so I'm not clear on just how we managed that, but we ended up at the base again, and that was successful.
Nice. And that was the second December ascent?
That's what
recorded?
Said, yes.
Okay. All right. And then from there, in that 1965-66 time period, you also mentioned some Grand Canyon caving with a fairly difficult entrance. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there are actually three such cases that we handled all about the same time. One of them was getting into Lang Cave, which was one of the caves that Western Speleological Institute had taken note of, but I didn't recall that they had actually been into that entrance, which was rather profoundly overhung below the top of the red wall on the south rim, sort of a central part of the south rim. I don't recall the exact drainage it overlooks. But
okay.
We actually got a fairly late start, as I recall. We had to walk several miles along the rim, the red wall rim, to come from our descent point higher up and get to the location of the cave. And there again, I don't know what we rigged the rope to. Things are not plentiful on the red wall rim, having few woody plants and that sort of thing. But we did, and if I recall, this was with Keith Wilson, a caver that I'd gotten to know from back east originally.
Hmm. How did you meet Keith?
Probably at an NSS convention back there.
Okay. So he was a caver as well?
Yes.
Okay.
So he rigged it and did the initial drop, and it had the problem that it was about 100 feet or a little more descent from the rim, with the red wall essentially overhung the entire way below that once you got below the bulge at the rim. And it put us 20 or 30 feet away from the actual entrance. So I had gotten a grappling hook. I don't remember. It was homemade. Made out of sorry for this confusion, but reinforcement rods and a triple prong.
Okay.
Three prong hook, and with an eye in the top. I still have it here in Denver, I think. And
like out of rebar?
Yeah, rebar.
Okay.
And so we had to actually stop about halfway down the drop and swing the hook back and forth until finally it caught behind a single large rock that was sitting on the very edge of the cave entrance, and rather massive, probably 5-6 feet long and a couple of feet high, so not so very likely to pull off there. Anyway, then rope on down until you were on the proper arc from the entrance, and then pull over on the rope until you could get your feet onto the rock. And
so I'm just trying to make sure I understand this, because the red wall, 350 feet of sheer cliff.
I think it was 450, and that was below the cave, not from the rim.
Okay, so there's a huge drop below you guys, and the end of your rope is dangling not that far below you.
Yes, actually, I remember the end of the rope blowing in the wind at times and blowing straight out from myself. And it was scarier than the long rappels I did inside caves, because there's a certain psychological difference when you're doing this in the dark, when you can't really see what you're up to in the cave and see only partway down the rope on a long rappel.
Right.
But in the Grand Canyon, it has no mercy on your emotions. Just everything in that place speaks of gravity. And
yeah.
What gravity can do to things. And when you have 450 feet of thin air underneath, I admit to being tense doing that feat. But we did manage to get into the cave.
So let me make sure I understand the logistics here. It sounds like Keith went first.
Yes, if I remember correctly.
And he went down with the grappling hook.
Yes.
And he would have swung that thing around, got it on a rock, rappelled on further down to where he thought he could then pull on the grappling hook rope and pull himself over to the wall. So he has to hang onto that rope pretty tightly and gain his balance on the ground. And then once he's on the ground, he can kind of walk up a little bit and then let the slack go on the grappling hook.
Yes, as I recall, the ground was almost flat right behind that rock, so
okay.
That was helpful.
So when he got there, he'd be okay. And then you're up above, so he's going to hang on to the end of the rope, or is he going to tie the grappling hook rope to your main line? You're going to rappel down so that you can use it to draw in, or was he going to pull you in?
He was going to pull me in. That was easier.
Okay.
Because he could get a good stance there and get some real energy into pulling in.
Got it. And then you guys must have had ascenders to jug back up.
Yes. Either ascenders or prussic knots at that point.
Right. Prussics, yeah.
Not sure.
Wow.
And they may have already been using Gibbs ascenders.
Okay. Yes.
So the cave turned out to be a somewhat mazy place of, I suppose, has 800 feet or so of passage in it. And
wow.
Had some interesting deposits for, I think, red and black minerals, which I later learned were indicative of rising water involvement in dissolving the cave.
Oh, interesting.
Mineralized water creating iron and manganese oxides as it rose into the zone of aeration in the water table in the cave. Deposit this material.
Any signs of condor occupation near the mouth?
Not in that cave, although there was in a much later thing that we visited, little Nancoepos, the north part.
Okay.
That's much later.
Okay. But 800 feet is a substantial distance. And were there feeders that you did not explore?
I don't remember seeing any leads that we would want to come back to.
Okay.
Unless maybe we were to dig at some point.
And roughly how large were the passageways?
Mostly walking sized.
Okay.
Somewhat larger at times. And not enormous, but a respectable cave.
Okay. Yeah. And no signs of human occupation?
No, that one I think beyond even the ingenuity of the climbing tribal people.
And no sign of Lang being in there.
I don't remember that he was. I don't really know how his name got attached to the cave.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think we were not the first in there, but whether it was Lang, maybe in my written account I might say something about it. I'm not sure.
Hmm. Okay.
So there was the other cave then farther to the west.
So were you guys, did you have backpacks? Were you going to spend the night next to this one and then hike on to the next one?
No, we weren't. We had to get back out of there.
Oh, wow.
And it was well into darkness by the time we got to the rim. And I remember that just starting a movement along the Redwall Rim there, I spotted this odd white object in the carbide light. Reached down, picked that up, and it turned out to be an old dry golf ball.
Oh, my.
I later learned from Doc Marston that among certain golfers who visited the Grand Canyon, there was this idea that they had that if they could whack a golf ball into the Grand Canyon, that's making a hole in one.
Oh.
And I found one of their holes.
Yes, you did.
I found another one. That wasn't the only one, but somewhere else below the rim. And on the Red Wall Zone, I found a golf ball. So there are probably dozens or hundreds of things down along there, to judge by the fact that in the night at a random spot,
yes,
I could find one.
Right. Right. That's amazing. Huh. Okay, so you guys hiked all the way out. On that trip to Lang Cave, were you planning to do other cave exploration, or did you retreat all the way back home to come all the way out?
It was a single purpose.
Single purpose, wow.
There was another cave that we had seen under the Redwall Rim, in this case, not with Keith Wilson, but with, what's his name? Names are really eluding me a lot these days.
Oh.
Anyway, with an Arizona caver that was also a climber of some ability. And so I don't remember from what point we saw the cave in the first place, but we saw it down there and were able to find a route to it and rigged the rope atop that, and there were just the two of us. Well, Gary Stiles, that was his name, and he encouraged me to actually try leading. I hadn't led in a whole lot in the way of scary climbing in my earlier activities in that line. And so in this case, we didn't have the grappling hook, so I found a rock about head-sized that was kind of constricted in the middle, and I tied that to the end of the rope, and I got down the 30 feet or so below the rim to where I could see the opening down there. And it also had a rock in the mouth, much like Lang Cave. So I stopped at least 50 feet above the cave mouth and began to swing the rock back and forth.
Oh!
Yes, you had to get a swing going on these things in order to get them in. If you waited till you were clear down near their level, you'd have had to do a horizontal rock throw, which would be a feat worthy of an Olympic sport, I think.
Right. I mean, so help me out, because I was thinking that's how Keith had gotten the rebar grappling hook over to the rock, was just by kind of throwing it over there. But you're saying, no, he actually kind of pendulumed it in and then dropped down further?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay. Not been clear on that, apparently. So I got down at that point and was able to swing the rock and then give it a good shove and toss and aimed correctly, and I hit behind the rock on the rim of the entrance.
Wow.
So then I got down there and tried to pull myself over, and about halfway over, the rock started sliding up.
Ooh.
The backside of the big rock was sloping and not perfectly horizontal, or vertical, I should say. So I just let go. I had tied off my rappel at that point and swung out. And then as I started swinging in, I grabbed the rope toward the cave and gave a little pull on that and got myself another 2 or 3 feet closer. And I just repeated this 3 or 4 times until I was having quite a good swing over the Red Bull Cliff. And, and finally I managed to land my feet on the rock. And I teetered there for seconds, as I recall, not quite in, not quite out, but the left wall of the cave was within my left hand reach, and I got my hand over there and was finally able to steady myself and tip into the cave instead of out of it. So
wow.
I made it. And so then Gary came down, and I pulled him over there.
Did you pendulum him over, or were you able just to muscle him over in one kind of...
I was able to muscle him over.
Okay.
A ledge along the side of the opening, as I recall.
Okay. Were you tied in when you did that? Or did you tie yourself in somehow with a little bit of safety?
I don't remember. I sort of doubt it, because I think I felt safe, or I didn't think, since I wasn't actually tied in such a way that that if he fell, he'd pull me over. I don't know for sure what I did.
Wow. My stomach's kind of churning just thinking about this, Donald. Holy cow, you're not tied in. You're swinging this guy out over the red wall, and you're going to just pull him on in and land him next to you. Wow. Okay.
Well, halfway next to me, because that ledge was a better point for him than it was for my initial drop.
Okay.
So we got off the rope, and we found that the passage went up almost parallel to the Red Bull Cliff, about a distance of 50 feet at maybe a 40-degree slope. And at the top, it angled into the cliff opening. There was another entrance up there that was barely head-sized, really, I think. And, well, I might have been able to crawl out of it if I'd been suicidal.
Mm.
Uh, take a picture of this head sticking out of the Red Wall Cliff.
Wow.
Sheer wall. So the cave ended up not going.
Oh, no.
It never went into dark zone. It didn't go far enough. More often than not, they won't, of course. If all the leads went, then we'd never have time to explore.
That's right. That's right. But what a lot of work to just go 50 feet.
But we were young and strong enough to handle it.
Yep.
And then the third instance, not very far in time from those other two, was a bit farther east in Hance Canyon. That is where a cave that WSI had first found, I think it was, down there, Bedaw Cave. They gave their new caves Navajo names.
Okay.
And Bedaw, or Tseon is the term for rock shoulder in Navajo, apparently. And so they call it Tseon Bedaw, which I forget what the Bedaw part of the name means in Navajo.
How do you spell that, Donald?
B-I-D-A.
Okay.
And I made one trip, I believe that was in 65, just trying to reach the cave, and my initial trip failed to get to it. It was involved going down the old Hance Trail and then along for half a mile or so and coming up from below to this great big opening, which they had explored the cave and tried to keep it quiet, but I'd warned of it in some way. And inside the cave, this big room was probably more than 50 feet across, and there was a fire pit in the back of it, and no telling whether that was Aboriginal or early white men built a campfire in it.
Was this a cave that you had to pendulum into?
No.
No, okay. So you were able to walk.
No, it was actually, didn't require rope work getting into the entrance.
So that means that people could have taken pinyon juniper or any other brush and drug it in there and lit it on fire to build
easily,
a fire. Got it. Okay.
No problem.
Okay.
But the cave narrows as you go in. Initially it goes into the cliff to the east and then angles to the right and goes hundreds of feet in that direction parallel to the cliff and then finally comes out again. And the cave, in all probability, predates the Hance Canyon completely.
Wow.
And originally all that probably went across. And if you looked across from the upper entrance, much smaller entrance to Bedaw Cave, there was an opening in the cliff over there, considerably smaller, but which I thought, well, very likely was a part of Bedaw system.
Oh.
And so we made plans to get into that and did it in much the same way, although it, as I recall, was not so profoundly overhung, maybe more like 10 or 15 feet. And again, we were able to get to a suitable point in the cave mouth that we could get off rope. And that turned out to be a few hundred feet of much smaller passage. It didn't go way back into the Red Wall as I'd hoped it was going to do. A paleo aquifer remnant.
Okay, okay.
But we called that one False Step Cave. I remember that on that, but I think I wrote in my account that we'd seen some sort of comic strip or something that the title was One False Step. And in this case, along the ledge, walking into it from the rope drop, if you made one false step, you could fall clear off the red wall.
Oh my gosh. Huh. There must be hundreds of caves near the top of the red wall, terribly karst material.
Yeah.
You did a river trip, I think, in 1981. We haven't gotten to that yet. And so you must have been looking and must have seen this throughout upper, middle, lower Granite Gorge. And as you look up the red wall, you can see caves. Did you give thought to trying to spend a larger amount of time exploring these caves?
Well, yes, although by the time that I did that river trip, that was actually an unknown to me at the time, but relatively close to the end of my intense activity level at the canyon. And so I would have been better off to have done the river trip much earlier in my canyon career, because then I'd have had more time left to get at the caves that I had noted from the river.
Hmm.
But it turned out that after I had marked all those off on maps on the river trip, I only ever got back to one of the leads I saw from the river, and that turned out to have been, or that someone had beaten me to it.
Hmm.
I think it was just a few months after I'd seen it then. But I did get to go to another cave that ended up connecting to it. That was, again, later still, I think, in perhaps 1993. Yeah, I was on another helicopter trip then that involved going down into the head of Little Nanqueep and looking for archaeological material in the caves down there.
Should we take a tangent right now and go to that trip, or should we wait for the timeline to get to it?
It's sort of up to you, I think, as to what you want the interview to be structured as.
Yeah, let's try to stick to the timeline.
Okay.
Because I was just thinking that you had also mentioned you had done some work as an interpreter for the Park Service. And I'm thinking this is in the 1960s. The Badake was 65.
Yeah.
When did you start your interpretive career with the park?
The actual critical element to that was at least a year before that. I was on the North Rim doing one of the canyon trips off there, and I met the man that was then the chief interpreter on the North Rim, John Stockert by name.
How do you spell John's last name?
Stockert.
Okay.
And I had a little conversation with him in which I mentioned that I was interested in seeing if I could get a national park job, and he listened to me. And then a year later, in the early summer or spring of 1967, I, to my surprise, got a phone call from John Stocker, who had left Grand Canyon to take over as chief naturalist at Badlands National Monument, South Dakota, and he had an opening then that he needed to fill quickly, and was interested in going into work as a seasonal naturalist for him then. And so I agreed, and I immediately quit my job as a library aide in La Mirada, California, and moved off for that summer to South Dakota and interpreted that for the visitors to the monument.
So when I think of the Badlands, South Dakota Badlands National Park, I think of kind of the Painted Desert.
Well, there's some similarity in that they're both, I think, claystone landscapes in which fossilization has taken place. In the Painted Desert, petrified wood is the primary thing that it's famous for. Badlands, rather, is early Cenozoic clay or material and has animals or mammals dating from relatively early after the dinosaur killing asteroid impact.
So we're 65 million years, something like that?
Actually less or old, half that age, I think.
Oh, 30 million.
Yes.
Okay.
So I forget now because I had two seasons, the summers there, 67 and 68. But in one of those seasons, I got to know Mike Rock, a caver who lived in Rapid City.
Hmm.
And he was planning an ascent of the Devil's Tower.
Ooh.
I had always thought, well, this would be a very neat thing if I was able to climb it. And so I agreed to ride my motorcycle back 60 miles to Rapid City and tried doing that with him. And I recall that before that I'd met him at an actual motorcycle racetrack south of Rapid City.
Hmm.
And he had this buddy he was talking to that I had just seen do what looked to me quite a dangerous motorcycle run around a track there. And I thought, well, they'd have to be pretty gutsy to do this. And so he comes up to us after that, and he and Mike knew each other, and he was talking to Mike, who said that we were going to climb Devil's Tower tomorrow. And he said, oh, I'd never dare do that. That's too scary. Which sort of blew me away. He had his own version of scary behavior. And it was different from ours.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And I didn't have really good climbing boots at that time, but I think it was Mike that lent me a pair of clutter shoes, a lightweight climbing shoe, which it turned out was good for me. And I enjoyed that climb a lot more than I had the Shiprock climb several years before. For the Devil's Tower was solid rock. It had all these big basalt columns composing it, and I didn't fear, once I'd got the feel of that, that these were going to crumble out under me as I had on the Shiprock climb. And I didn't lead, he did, but
okay.
I did actually take a fall midway up, and I had the presence of mind to yell falling. I went 6 feet or so before the belay caught me. And I imagine that the spectators down below got a little thrill when I said that.
Yeah, when across the basin below you heard falling.
Yes.
I was like, okay.
Luckily, I didn't get hurt in any way. And just climbed on up the crack. I'd gotten, I think, overconfident and a little careless in the move where I fell. But that's the only scary event that I remember happening. And one reason I'd wanted to climb that is that I always was interested in the effects of grazing on the prairie.
Oh.
And there were very few places where you could find a piece of prairie in that region that had never been grazed by livestock. And I knew the summit of Devil's Tower could never have been
right.
grazed by cattle or sheep.
Right, and what did you find?
I found that it was just short grass prairie that looked a whole lot like the rest of it.
Really?
Yes, it wasn't as different as I really expected it to be.
And what did you kind of, what do you think was going on there?
In what sense?
Well, in that case, it sounded like the short grass prairie that was being grazed wasn't being overgrazed.
Apparently not all that much, at least around there.
Okay.
But I was disappointed that it was so nearly similar as I couldn't really
Interesting.
Tell the difference.
Interesting. And then the rappel down, how many pitches was it on the climb up? Do you remember roughly?
I don't remember on the climb up. It seemed like we did about three rappels, double rappels, and pulled it down after us.
Okay.
At least that many.
Did you come down in the dark?
No, it was daylight still.
Okay. Summertime then, so.
Yes. Yeah, that's when I would have had to be there, of course, working as a summer naturalist.
Okay. Did you enjoy your time there at Badlands?
Oh, I enjoyed those occasional outings more than I really did the work at Badlands. It was interesting. I did find an oreodont skull when I was rambling around in one of the ravines near the...
What's an oreodont?
An oreodont is a rather pig-like animal that lived in the, I think it was Miocene age when that rock was deposited.
Wow.
But this muzzle was sticking out of the clay there, and I reported that to the park, and I'm not sure if it was collected or not, but it certainly was a well-preserved-looking skull.
Hmm.
It was a common thing to be walking around below that escarpment and finding the plates of old turtle shells.
Wow. Huh. Interesting. So, your job with the tourists was to tell them about the Badlands, how they were formed, answer their questions about fossils and places to hike and things like that?
Yes.
Okay. Did that get tedious in the sense of repetition after a while?
I have to admit that it did.
Okay. You're not alone in that. I appreciate your candor. And that's difficult. It's like you say the same thing again and again and again and again and again.
I did give campfire programs in the latter part of the season.
Okay. Was that fun?
I think it was more pleasing than just the desk work.
Okay. And where did you stay when you were there? Did they have housing for you?
They did, yes. A little motel style structure that several employees could live in.
Okay.
And then from there, I did get another seasonal appointment at Big Bend National Park. That was a winter season, though, and it was what they called a 180-day appointment, which actually amounted to being there about 3 months. Nine months.
Oh, wow.
3 months was the summer appointment. But at Badlands, I was hoping to find some caves. At Big Bend, I was hoping to find some caves because there are three massive mountain ranges of solid limestone about 1,500 feet thick there.
Wow.
Cretaceous limestone in southwest Texas.
Okay.
But as it turned out, I did do some hikes on those, but I found almost nothing in the way of caves, and a few that were around had previously mostly been known, so I was rather baffled at the time. It seemed like there ought to be more caves there than I was finding. binding. And subsequently, I learned more about hypogene speleogenesis, in which the caves are formed from acid fluids coming from below and then mixing with either oxygenated water near the water table or with actual air surface where it would oxidize hydrogen sulfide. And that is how Carlsbad Cavern was created. But at Big Bend, I think there was just no matching petroleum deposit. So the caves there were few and far between.
Huh.
And mostly filled with sediment even then.
Interesting. Did John Stockert, did he help you get that Big Bend job? How did you hear about that?
I don't remember exactly how that went, but it probably did because I recall having the offer made before I had left the Badlands.
Oh, okay. All right. And Big Bend has the Rio Grande going through Santa Elena Canyon?
Yes, and also through Mariscal and Boquillas Canyon.
Boquillas, yes.
Yes. And that was where I did the first actual whitewater rafting that I had done. And the park employees are going to have a trip down Mariscal Canyon and invited me to be on that. So I accepted, and we were in a two-man raft, I think. And the Rio Grande at that point was lower than usual, and most of the time, I said it exactly wrong, it was higher than usual.
Okay.
Most of the time, the water would be funneled through a slot beside a huge flat rock that crossed much of the river course there. So you were supposed to point your watercraft into that chute, even though the water was higher on this trip, and it was about 2 feet deep where it was pouring over that rock.
Hmm.
And my supervisor, who was the lead boatman, made a mistake and went over it about 15 feet too far to the north.
Oops.
So when the boat went over this waterfall, I was thrown out. I'd been spun around there toward the shore side, I think, and I found myself suddenly totally immersed in the waterfall. It was just, I just managed to grab onto the line around the raft by my hands, but with tons of water just smashing down on me, and I could barely chin myself strongly enough to get my head above the water. And when I did, I found that when I had been knocked out of there, the raft had kicked back a little, and at the point when I got up and could see, it was about 2 feet from where the waterfall was going under. And I said two-man raft before. Actually, it was three. And,
okay.
And the other two of them were paddling madly, trying to escape. It looked for a little bit as if we were going to be drifted back under the waterfall and flipped sideways, and have then one raft and three people and paddles being shunted back and forth between this waterfall and getting farther downriver. But just luckily, I think more by chance than by anything they were doing, there was a momentary lull that let us begin drifting back downstream. So I had been weakened enough by that ordeal that they had to help me back on board, and I lost my paddle. And luckily, a few hundred feet downriver from there, there was a Mexican, what's the term for that wax, Candelilla wax collector's camp on the Mexican side of the river, and my paddle had drifted in there, and they had found it and gave it back to us. And, but that left in my mind a very powerful, I wouldn't call it trauma exactly, but a sense of the real force of river water.
Yeah.
It was that it could and would kill you very easily if you made a mistake.
So, were you wearing a life jacket?
I believe so. I think we were doing all the things that we were supposed to be doing at the time.
Okay.
But the life jacket made essentially no difference when you were directly under 2 feet of falling river.
Right, right. Yeah. And were there other river runners back then, or was that an unusual thing?
Well, it was usual enough that the park at least had its own raft.
Okay.
But it wasn't exactly raft after raft then.
Right. And so you guys were in a park raft?
Yes.
Okay.
And subsequently, I did also get to do Mariscal and Boquillas Canyons. And Mariscal had a cave on the Mexican side that was maybe 200 feet long, and had that guano had been mined by the Mexicans for guano for a while.
Hmm.
And I did a bit of climbing also while down there. The Mesa de Anguilla was directly above the Mariscal Canyon, and you could walk up onto it if you did it to the west of there, but I was interested in seeing if I could get up directly at the eastern face of the limestone cliff there, and I found a way to do that, actually, and was able to top out on there without having to use rope, but nowadays I think I would have found it much more frightening attempting that. And I hooked up with a couple of young men who were camping in the park for a while, and then I did that with them and had some good times there.
Okay.
And I had also an interest in cacti.
Oh, wow.
From my boyhood. And Big Bend has perhaps the most varied cactus population of any of the American parks. Although Arizona is better known for cacti because some of the ones there are arborescent, the sorrels, of course, widely known. And cacti and Big Bend are not as big, but the variety is quite remarkable.
Hmm. Interesting. And were you there during the bloom, when the cactus were in bloom?
I was there when some of them were blooming.
That would be pretty.
Also, I was able to find a place 100 miles east of there where there was a native population of the peyote cactus.
Oh, wow.
Which grew, it turned out, in limestone and was very protectively colored, sort of grayish-green.
Huh.
Spineless plants that you had to be looking for them to be able to see them. And I couldn't find any in Big Bend National Park proper, except at one site down on the east side of the high mountains there. There was a large old Indian site, and there were several large peyote plants growing there. And we suspected that that actually was probably cultivated, brought there by whoever had been in the country at that time, and that they were growing cacti for whatever use they were then making of peyote.
Were you aware of the hallucinogenic properties of peyote at the time?
Well, I was, but I didn't indulge in them. I was more conservative than that.
Okay. All right. And do you remember who the chief of interpretation was or the superintendent was at the time at Big Ben?
Let's see, the chief of interpretation, Roland Wauer.
How do you spell Roland's last name?
W-A-U-E-R.
Okay.
And under him there was another person who was my direct supervisor and who was the one on the river trip, but I'm having trouble remembering his name.
Okay.
But all this time I was wishing I could be in the Grand Canyon because that was where I really wanted to be exploring.
Did you then use your interpretive experience to apply for an intern job at Grand Canyon?
Yes, I never got one.
Okay.
But what I did get was, at the end of the stay at Big Bend, I don't know quite how that came about, but I had been asked if I would take a 180-day appointment as a cave guide, a tour guide at Carlsbad Cavern, which I thought was the next best thing, and I accepted that. And
was that for the Park Service?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I was there in 1970 for most of that year, and then I recall 2 weeks into 1971 when the appointment expired.
So that was another six-month appointment?
At least here, 6 or 9.
Okay. I mean, I just have a vision of Br'er Rabbit being thrown into the briar patch.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that that rabbits love briar patches, at least so the cartoon goes, and it would have just been wonderful to get a chance to work at Carlsbad if you had had a chance to spend some time exploring the cave as a caver.
Which related to a grievance that I developed against the superintendent.
Ooh.
Carlsbad, because I had been doing a few off-trail trips with the Guadalupe Cave Survey people, whom I had initially met through exploring Fort Stanton Cave 100 miles north of there. And so I applied to the superintendent for permission to be a trip leader on my own, and he turned me down.
So was this like a commercial service you wanted to do, or did you want to actually work for the Park Service leading caving trips?
I didn't want to do either of those. I wanted to simply do cave exploration and study, not necessarily as a job for anybody, but rather the way that the Guadalupe Cave Survey cavers did, just visit the cave and select a good place for a survey. And I wanted to have the freedom to plan that sort of thing on my own, and the superintendent, whose name was Donald Dayton, he wasn't that well liked among the seasonals. He got the nickname Donald Duck.
Oh, huh.
But actually, my own initials are the same as his, and I've been known to be called Donald Duck in high school.
Oh, huh. So let me make sure I get this right. You're offering to the superintendent to continue with the mapping of this resource for free?
Yes.
And he said no?
Yes. I asked him why, and all he could say was that, we let these people who have institutional responsibility from other outside work be trip leaders here, but you don't have a record of institutional responsibility that would justify this. I thought it made absolutely no sense
Wow, so he was basically saying you were irresponsible. That's nice.
Yep.
Hmm. Wow. Okay. So did that, every time one completes a seasonal stint, you know, you get reviewed, a job performance review, I guess is what I was thinking of. But did you, like, you were, I'm done with the Park Service at that point because of that relationship with Dayton?
Well, I didn't really formulate a formal thought to that effect, I don't think. Things are going on in my life. I don't have a very clear memory of my overall whereabouts and activities during the period from 1971 onward, except that the Cavers, as I've explained, employ carbide miners' lamps, or did at that time, as their primary light source. And it happened that the manufacturers of carbide lamps in the United States had gone out of business.
Right.
But somehow I had gotten hold of a Premier carbide lamp, a Premier brand, from England, where they were still being made. And I thought that was a good quality carbide lamp. And I began to, while I was away in Colorado after that job in Carlsbad, I began to see if I could import those and maybe become a vendor of carbide lamps to the caving community and make some money that way. So I wrote to the Premier company, and they let me do that, and for a few years I was the only authorized dealer in Premier lamps. So it was only a sort of minor kind of living, but it gave me enough to get by on that, and I guess odd things of other sorts. I can't call it all to mind very well now.
Did Premier require like a minimum purchase they would then box up and send over?
Something like that, yes.
Okay.
I had to go through a customs procedure for parcels and so forth.
Okay. And then how did you get the word out through the caving community or anybody else?
I put an ad in the NSS News.
Oh, okay.
As well as being at conventions and the like.
Okay. Did you have a name or a little company?
No, I didn't bother to name a company. I just gave my address, which I was using my brother's address at that time in Fairplay because it was more stable than what I had otherwise. The one thing I was consistently doing was I was interested in getting back into beekeeping. I had left a few hives with my Colorado friends while I was living elsewhere for several years. So I was interested in, especially in finding a property on the western slope, and because the best Colorado cave area was in that region near Glenwood Springs to the south and southeast. And so I wanted to see if I could actually get a stable place to live over there, and I kept looking at various ways of finding land, and I looked at one property near Newcastle that had nothing on it, but it would have cost $10,000, I couldn't afford that much. So not long after that, I somehow came to hear of a place near Ruleson which was a small unincorporated town between Rifle and the Grand Valley. There was an acre and a half there with a shack on it that I could have for $3,310.
Wow.
So I took that up, and I bought that in late in 1972, but I barely got over there that year. But in 1973, I began to spend my summers mainly in Ruleson.
How do you spell that, Ruleson?
Pardon?
How do you spell Ruleson?
Oh, R-U-L-I-S-O-N. The only source of fame it has was being the location where they set off an atomic bomb after the World War, and the so-called Project Plowshare, where they were trying to find excuses to keep their jobs in the Atomic Energy Commission, and were testing to see if they could frack the natural gas with atomic bombs, but that was a few years later. Anyway, a few years earlier, I'm sorry. So I ended up getting back the few colonies of bees that had survived and then beginning to build them up. And I spent some years in Ruleson's summers, and I got about 45 colonies of bees.
Wow.
At my largest, which was small for a commercial operation, but large for a hobby operation.
Yeah.
And I had been raised the bees and the honey during the summer, and then with my partner Chester, we would go back in the winters into Denver, where we had the alternating dwelling, which in fact I'm sitting in here now.
Okay.
And try to sell the honey at the flea markets and to our friends and families. So that's the way life went there for quite some time. But I ended up being rather frustrated in terms of having wanted to move over there because it was near cave country. Because actually being responsible for a property that had an irrigated orchard and garden as well as bees, it took a lot of time and energy. And I didn't have local caving partners. They were still mostly on the eastern slope. So I would have to make arrangements to meet them partway over to the cave country to make the trips. So I would probably have been better off in that respect if I hadn't done what I did. But you may have gathered by this time that I never had an ordinary American career going to an office 5 days a week and conforming to dress, clothes, and the like. And
right.
I'm
surprised you lasted as long as you did with the Park Service.
Yeah, I am myself in a way, but partly that was frustrating because I couldn't be out with my gayness, and I was sexually deprived when I was off in these rather isolated regions.
All right, yeah.
Summers, but yeah. Anyway.
I have a couple, two questions for you. I wanted to go back to the carbide lanterns from a premiere as an authorized dealer. What were you selling brand new lanterns for?
Something like $15, as I recall.
$15? Wow. I mean, today I'm like, gee, I'll buy 10. But back then, 15 was a little more than that. But still, that's a great price.
I could be just misleading you. It might not have been that high.
Oh, my.
I'd have to look at one of my old... what would I call it? Not a catalog, but a sheet of...
advertisement, a sales, yeah. Yeah. And then how did you meet Chester?
We were all involved in the Hikers Club in college.
Okay.
I met him there.
When you met Vin?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, we were on some hiking trips together, although Chester wasn't the kind of driven hiker that Vin was, and came to not like him very well because he would have a tendency to run off when he was leading trips, but if the rest of the people couldn't keep up, he wouldn't wait for them.
Oops.
But yeah. Anyway.
Huh. And how did you realize that Chester was interested in you?
Well, he seemed to like me, and we corresponded after leaving college. But he was primarily, his interests were political. He was in the anti-war movement, and after I met with him, and we were not together for a few years. We were still corresponding, and he was working for the American Friends Service Committee here in Denver for some time. And he set up a bookstore, an alternative bookstore, Together Books.
Oh, wow.
And was making his living that way for several years. He eventually got, we think, sort of cheated out of his share in that bookstore by his partners, and ended up being my beekeeping assistant when he had free time then.
Okay.
The carbide lamp business, eventually I don't think I was selling enough to suit Premier, so they dropped my status as sole importer.
Ooh.
Began letting the other caving supply places import them. And they outcompeted me because they sold a wider variety of gear, whereas I just had that one item, and so that ended. But by that time, I was making some money with the beekeeping, and it turned out that afterward I think it was around 1995, the parasitic mites first appeared in Rulison, and we left the beehives in the winter and then came back in the spring, and almost all the colonies were dead.
Oh, wow.
And so in the meantime, I had actually been getting somewhat stressed keeping bees by that time. Physically, it was really hard work. Having to heft around 65-pound hive bodies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And with medium supers, 35 pounds. And it was strenuous labor, and I had to get the crops clear to the eastern slope in my old panel truck.
Wow.
And forth. And
yeah.
So I just, when the bees were dead that spring, I just decided, well, this is long enough. I'm not doing it any longer. And gave that up. But I tried to hang on in Rulison just with the orchard and gardening. But it wasn't working out all that well. There'd always been some trouble with people robbing my water right and so forth. And,
oh, wow.
That I couldn't solve properly, and I should have left sooner than I did, I think. But when I finally did, it turned out that the money I made from Rulison after I sold the place was more than I had made living there.
Oh, my.
You may be wondering, oh, how can that work out? And what happened was that my property, acre and a half, still had the mineral rights. Nobody else had put a claim on the mineral rights.
Wow.
When I first bought the place, that was the last thing I had in mind, because I figured, what on earth, there's no gold, silver, lead, or anything of that sort. But in tens of miles of here, so that probably didn't make any difference. And that actually turned out otherwise, that nothing happened for some years, and then they began to develop the gas fields in the Ruleson area, and it turned out that I had a friend in the cavers, Harvey Duchesne, who was a professional geologist in gas and oil, and he said, well, you can make money from the mineral rights, and you should negotiate, because what they'll offer you is not necessarily as much as they'd be willing to go for.
Oh.
So I didn't really have the option of simply doing nothing and refusing to let them take the oil or the gas. You can always do that, but then they make the property what they call into forced pooling. They can actually force the landowners to allow drilling, and that you'll likely get more pay for it, and for that matter, better terms for surface use if you agree to a contract than if you are stubborn and try to hold out.
Right.
So I actually got a contract better than the standard for this thing, and even for an acre and a half, then it went along for some years, paying maybe $100, $150 a month.
Oh, wow.
But nothing big until finally there was a boom in gas not long after I actually sold my property, but I took care to reserve the mineral rights.
Ah.
Which turned out to be the right decision. I got only $45,000 for the property, which had been deemed by the county not a buildable lot because it was too narrow. But then
$45,000? Wait a minute. You only paid $3,310 for it in the first place.
Oh, yeah. So I certainly made money.
Oh, my gosh.
But year by year, I wasn't making that much.
Right.
So finally, the big gas boom came along after I was living back on the eastern slope. And at the height of that, for a year or two, I was getting $10,000+ a year.
My gosh.
At my income level was very significant money.
You bet.
And also, my family had owned a mineral right to a claim up near Mount Democrat, one of the 14ers above timberline at 12,000 feet. And the Climax and Libdenham Company had intentions of expanding their operations over to that side of the mountains, and they wanted that claim, so my mother, brother, and I ended up dividing the option money that Climax was paying for that. So I ended up getting a $10,000 payment for that, and then they dropped the option. They were starting to lose money, apparently, and lost interest in coming over there, which I'm glad happened, because I hadn't actually seen what Climax and Libdenham was doing on the other side of the range until recent years, when I drove that highway. And they made a hellscape out of that valley and on that side, and just utterly wrecked whole mountains with that and stripped them. And they presumably have done the same thing on the Alma side if they had gotten into it soon enough.
Hmm. Okay. We've covered a ton of ground and been talking here for about an hour, 20 minutes. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this oral history.
Okay, so be it.
Is there anything else you'd like to bring in that we've covered today that I didn't ask you about?
Well, just that, about myself, really, that I've been able to do this orthodox or this unorthodox life with some luck, like the moral rights. And,
yeah.
And by doing little niche things, and but I've always tried to live modestly. Of course, by world standards, I live like a king. I don't have to live like the poor people in all those other countries in the old world. But still, as an American, I'm considered in poverty, and my income level is well under the poverty line for annual income. But I've been able to accumulate savings. I didn't mention that I was able to buy the Ruleson land with cash. I'd made enough savings to pay the $3,310 without having to go into debt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a principle in my life never to go into debt for anything.
Nice.
Save until you can afford it, and then
yes.
So I nice. Like to think I've done my share, at least in terms of trying to keep the planet from going to hell. But even then, it's still nowhere enough, and I'm expecting utter disaster to come to humanity in none too many more years.
Okay. Yeah. Well, on that not quite so cheery note, we'll go ahead and conclude part 5 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Donald Davis. Today is Sunday, January 29th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Donald, thank you so very, very much.
Oh, thank you for your interview.